The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this Friday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Now, coming up later in the program, think about this. 32% of women leave STEM degree programs in college, and only 30% of women who earn those bachelor's degrees in engineering are still working in the field 20 years later. Lots of questions. We'll talk about the reasons why. But we'll begin with this. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp says more Georgians will soon be able to get COVID-19 vaccines.
Starting March 8th, we will expand the current 1A plus vaccination criteria to cover more high-risk Georgians, including adults with intellectual or developmental disabilities and their caregivers, as well as the parents of children who have complex medical conditions. Additionally, I believe it is vitally important for more Georgians to return to normal. We must have every student back in the classroom 5 days a week statewide. To ensure that happens as quickly as possible, effective March 8th, pre-K, K through 12, public and private school teachers and faculty, and the Department of Early Care and Learning educators and staff will now be eligible for the vaccine.
And Governor Kemp making that announcement at the state capitol yesterday. Now, Kemp added he does not plan to mandate Georgia schools return to in-class instruction, but he added he hopes expanded access to the vaccine motivates more districts to actually resume in-class instruction. Now, the rate of new daily coronavirus cases continues to increase. More than 2,200 new cases were reported yesterday. So now this brings Georgia's total to 812,612 total coronavirus cases reported since last March. And at that current rate, the state will likely reach 15,000 recorded deaths this weekend. Right now, at this hour, it's 14,989 Georgians who have died due to the virus. And as always, we get our information from the Georgia Department of Public Health. In other news from another department, the Georgia Department of Labor is reporting more than 25,000 first-time unemployment claims for last week. That's about 1,000 fewer than a week before. But here's something else to keep in mind. Since the beginning of all this, when the pandemic, officials have processed over 4.4 million initial unemployment claims for here in Georgia. Now, to put this in perspective, think about this. That 4.4 million is more than the combined claims from 2011 to 2020. Those who worked in the hotel and restaurant industries continue to lead the unemployment claims here in Georgia. And finally, one of Atlanta's sports teams has been sold. The Atlanta Dream have been sold, once owned by former Georgia Senator Kelly Loeffler. Atlanta's WNBA team will now be owned by Larry Gotsendiner. He's chairman of Northland, an industry-leading national real estate firm. But there's more to this because this investor group also includes former Atlanta Dream star Renee Montgomery, as well as Northland president and CEO Susanna Abier. This is Closer Look. And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. If you have been tested for COVID-19, more than likely you've taken the nasopharyngeal swab test. Say that 16 times. The swab has to pass through your nostril to the very back of the nasal cavity, and it can be very uncomfortable. Well, in response to that, and also to help combat COVID-19, at the University of Georgia, scientists at UGA's Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratories recently adapted a saliva COVID-19 test. And join me now to talk more about this and some other news and information from UGA. I'm joined now by Dr. Susan Sanchez, professor of infectious diseases at UGA. And she also heads the microbiology and molecular biology in UGA's College of Veterinary Medicine Diagnostic Laboratory. Also, Dr. Jesse Hostetter, the Barry C. Harmon Professor of Pathology in the College of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you both for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Welcome. Thank you for inviting us.
Let's begin here, and I'll start with you, Dr. Sanchez. I'm curious, what kinds of research were you working on prior to COVID-19?
My main interest of research is antimicrobial resistance. So those are my main areas. And also looking at new pathogens that affect animals and cause disease. So those have been my main areas of research before working with COVID.
Okay. And what about you, Dr. Hostetter? What were you working on before all this COVID-19?
Well, I'm the new department head for pathology, and also I lead the diagnostic lab. So I'd been here about 8 months when this all started. So I was still getting settled into my new role here at UGA.
Hmm. Let me stay with you for a moment, Dr. Hostetter, because then all of a sudden, of course, the pandemic and we have all this. And now how much of what you all has changed because of COVID-19 in terms of research and any initiatives that you all were working on? How much of your work has changed now?
Well, it certainly has taken a turn, and I think both for Dr. Sanchez and I. For me, it meant that we had to look at ways to make sure we are keeping our personnel and our students all safe, and that we were trying as best as we could to keep some of our functions going, especially our diagnostic services that we rely on at UGA, but also through the state of Georgia. So it was a big curve in the road for us.
And you all are obviously so used to working so close to each other. Dr. Sanchez, what about precautions? You all had to shift. Is that easy to do in a setting like you all have? Because safety now is a priority.
That's correct. No, it was a challenge. That was one of our main challenges, to work all together and safely, trying to stagger shifts whenever possible, trying to keep distances, mapping on the ground. We're 6 feet away from each working station. That was pretty hard. And trying to work with COVID, which adds another dimension, biosafety was critical. So staff learned how to use respirators and golden poppers, personal protective equipment, when working. So that was an interesting challenge. But everybody in the team rose to it, and we did well.
You did well. Dr. Sanchez, let me stay with you for a moment. Did you have anyone who contracted the virus? Was everyone okay throughout this whole process?
Everybody stayed safe through the whole process. We didn't have anybody going down with COVID-19 all through the year, or even this year.
And Dr. Hostetter, UGA, obviously being a research university as well, you all, you mentioned things changed pretty quickly for you all. Take our listeners through what you all have been working on as it relates to COVID-19. And then Dr. Sanchez, you can follow up as well.
Well, specifically, you know, what we've been working on in the diagnostic setting is the testing for COVID-19. And we stood up with the university, stood up a testing site on our campus to test students, faculty, and staff. And so that's been progressing since last August. We also have researchers here at the University of Georgia that are working actively on COVID-19, and they're looking at a number of different really critical areas, things like, you know, vaccination and detection and immunity, all of those critical areas.
Dr. Sanchez, what do you want to add to that?
Here at UGA, we have lots of researchers. And in addition to some of these things that Dr. Hostetter has mentioned, we have a team in public health that are looking at sewage treatment water, to look at early alerts on potential infectious diseases, including COVID, right now. And they you know, like in other places, they believe that they can alert that the presence of the virus, or high presence in the community, before actually we have cases in the community. So that's one of the efforts that is ongoing, as well as trying to sequence the COVID-19 SARS-CoV-2, looking for variants.
Before we get into the saliva test, I want to just get you all to focus and reflect on just your own thoughts on COVID-19 and from the variants to now the vaccine. What do you make of just this whole journey for the entire world since last year? Dr. Sanchez, you start.
It's been a very challenging journey, but all researchers and everybody has moved towards a resolution. Everybody has worked together like they never had before, sharing information, sharing data and sequences, which has allowed us to really start with diagnostic tests to know what the virus was. And I still astonished the way that NIH worked with private partner and created private partnerships to get the vaccine out there, and it's now working in even in better diagnostics. So it's unprecedented the way we have collaborated, both within UGA, within the state, because we have worked with Georgia Tech, Georgia State. So we work together through this pandemic, but also the national and international level. So I think if anything come out of this, is partnership and research is not an individual thing, it's a team thing, and human health is priority.
Dr. Sanchez, I want to follow up with this question. Were you, if they said, you know what, we think we can have this vaccine within a year, and of course you all, of all people, know that it can sometimes take up to a decade. What did you think when you start hearing that, okay, it's possible to have a vaccine within a year? I mean, as a scientist, as a researcher, what went through your mind?
That was going to be very, very hard, yeah. Without collaboration. I'm part of NIH as a council member, and I was privy to some of the information that NIH was working on these partnerships, and they were very confident that they were going to be able to push this through and get a vaccine in a short period of time. So it was an effort from all federal agencies, including the FDA, mm-hmm. and private and public partnerships. So that's what's made it all faster. It's not about one group getting the leg ahead and making the profit. It's about all of us trying to solve a big problem, and it showed.
Indeed. Dr. Hostetter, let me get that first question to you. What do you make of all this as a researcher and scientist and someone? What's been your takeaway from all of this?
Well, I would echo Dr. Sanchez's comments. You know, this has been, you know, extremely difficult time, but it is somewhat amazing to see all of the levels of expertise and where each of those levels can fit in to help with a plan, whether that's a new research program or a new method of diagnostics. And, you know, from multiple places, the IT departments, the infectious disease departments, mm-hmm. Engineering departments, you know, it was really eye-opening to see the level of support and interest and enthusiasm for rolling up sleeves and getting into and tackling a problem.
And what about the notion that a vaccine could come within a year? When you started hearing that, what went through your mind?
Well, you know, two things. One, hope. At the time when we first heard that, it certainly was something that we wanted to hear. But two was concern that, you know, my area is not vaccine development, but mm-hmm. I know that it takes a long time, especially to get all of the approvals for safety and efficacy. And so I was hopeful, but I wanted to just wait and see if this would really pan out.
And I understand that UGA's veterinary diagnostic laboratories played a major role in testing animals right here in Georgia for the virus. I'll let you start with that one. Dr. Hostetter, tell our listeners about that.
We started, testing animals for the virus. Now, these were high-risk animals. that either came from homes with positive owners, or these animals were displaying symptoms of infection themselves. And so mm-hmm. both our diagnostic labs here in Athens and in Tifton, Georgia, which is also affiliated with UGA, were testing animals. This wasn't a large number of animals, but it was important early on when we just really didn't understand how far the virus would reach into other species besides people.
And are we just talking about the domestic animals, like, you know, cats and dogs, and maybe, you know, if someone owned a bird or something, or are we talking about livestock here?
Here in our diagnostic labs, it was mainly cats and dogs. Across the nation, of course, there have been zoo animals, mm-hmm. Wild cats that have been tested as well, and I believe primates have been tested.
And what have you all been able to find out about this? And Dr. Sanchez, if you can jump in there too as well.
Dr. Sanchez jump in on that.
Dr. Sanchez, what have you all been able to find in terms of COVID and animals?
Well, that is not as common as we once thought it could be. And basically that animals are just asymptomatic carrier if an owner has a lot of, shed a lot of virus. Mm-hmm. So it's not something really we should worry too much about. But definitely in certain species, like the large cats in zoo collections and in non-human primates, is a problem. But luckily, those are confined and they're in a specific zoo collections. It's not a big deal. But we didn't know, like Dr. Hostetter mentioned, we didn't know anything about it earlier on during the pandemic. So we wanted to be ready in case that was an issue. And that's part of the mission of the diagnostic labs, to mm-hmm. be ready for new and emerging diseases in this bridge between human and animal, between human and animal health, zoonoses that can be transmitted. And we knew that SARS-CoV-2 was a zoonosis. So we wanted to make sure we put all the stops so we knew that we can respond if the public needed us.
If you just join us, I'm joined by Dr. Susan Sanchez, and she's a professor of infectious diseases at UGA and also the head of the microbiology and molecular biology in the university's College of Veterinary Medicine Diagnostic Laboratory. And Dr. Jesse Hostetter, he's the Barry G. Harmon Professor of Pathology, also in the College of Veterinary Medicine, and executive director of the Tifton and Athens Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratories. Y'all got a lot of titles there, but I'm sure it's for a very good reason. All right, let's get to this COVID-19 saliva test, because let's be clear. We know the COVID test is important, but it can be uncomfortable. So let's talk about how you all got to this point of saying, you know what, we're going to tweak this a little. How did all this come about?
Well, I guess I could start. You know, we wanted to make testing as easy as possible. Mm-hmm. And when this all started, we began testing last August. You know, what we had available to us was the NP swab, which you described it pretty accurately. Mm-hmm. And there were some people that shied away from that. And so we looked around at what other tests that were out there, and the saliva test seemed very attractive to us just because it was something that might be a little friendlier to use, mm-hmm. and we might get more people to come to the testing center if we went that route, and it would be easier for them.
So you had some folks who just wouldn't take it because it is just a little uncomfortable. And look, I can understand some folks saying, look, it's just, I just can't do it. So that was, did you have a lot of folks? Did you start to notice, you know what, this is the reason why people don't want to get the test?
I think there were some. I don't think it was a large number. Mm-hmm. I think there were people that would come and get the test. It's not a long process. And getting an NP swab, you know, you could get it done in under a couple of minutes. There were people who definitely avoided it, but there were people who couldn't take that test. And there are certain medications that people are on where they can't use a nasopharyngeal swab. And so that was a group of people we wanted to reach out to, too, and to make sure that they were included in this opportunity to get tested.
Can you take that further for our listeners who may not understand? What do you mean, folks who are not or unable?
Sure. Blood thinners. Anyone who's taken an anticoagulant or a blood thinner, uh-huh. And has a risk for a nosebleed, that's not a great idea to have an NP swab test done.
So how long did it take for, I mean, y'all just said, well, look, let's just try the to lava. And then it may sound simplistic because I know it's not. But then from that process, how long did it take to say, well, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to do it? And to know that it would be effective in detecting the virus.
I'll answer the first part and turn that second part over to Dr. Sanchez, because that's her area. We started, you know, we were looking around what our neighbors were doing and other universities were doing. And the saliva test was, we saw that there was benefit for the reasons I mentioned, that it was easy on the person giving the sample. Mm-hmm. We probably started talking about this probably in mid-fall, maybe October or even earlier. And, you know, it took some time because there are some nuances, and we had to, one, make it safe. Both safe for the person giving the test, but also the healthcare providers that are working in the area. So mm-hmm. we didn't want, you know, risk of contamination and those kinds of things. We wanted that to be at a minimum. And we wanted to make it so that we could safely collect the sample, seal it up, and get it back to the lab without leakage and those kinds of problems. And so, you know, we started thinking about this in the fall. We ran our first sample, by the holidays, and these were just a very low number of samples to mm-hmm. kind of, if you will, beta test the new sampling kit. And then we really started ramping it up in early January, all the time making continual changes and tweaks to our plan to make sure that it was working the best that it could.
Dr. Sanchez, how effective is the test?
Very effective. We detect the same number of positives and the same number of negatives, which we tested side by side, nasopharyngeal swabs from the same person with saliva mm-hmm. swabs from the same person. So just trying to put together all the samples to be able to validate the test that we were going to be running took a little bit of time, as well as changing our workflows, because working with an NP swab is different than working with a saliva sample and how you process that sample mm-hmm. Before the RNA extraction, the nucleic acid extraction. So that took some time. But the validation, once we worked out the workflows, the validation per se was probably only took us 3 or 4 weeks once we had all the samples together to complete. And as Dr. Hostetter mentioned, and before the holidays, we ran several samples just to get familiar. Every time you change the workflow, and you're dealing with high throughput, large numbers, it becomes difficult. You have 3 or 4 samples, it's okay. But when you end up with 500 or 1,000 samples, it becomes a little more complicated. And you want everybody to have the results as soon as possible. So our idea has always been to turn results within 24, 48 hours if we can.
That was my next question. So you're saying the results can be obtained in 24 to 48 hours?
Yes, maximum is 72 hours in some situations because some tests need to be repeated. But right now with the saliva test and the way we process, some results are obtained the same day. So we can really turn things around very quickly.
Dr. Sanchez, I imagine as a listener saying, well, that's great. So why aren't these readily available to the general public as the nasal swab COVID test? What do you think?
I'm not certain why that is, but I think it has to do with potentially with two things, saliva and processing it. Mm-hmm. And most of these samples we get readily, so they get collected that day and they come to us that same very day. So we can process that saliva sample very quickly. If you mm-hmm. have to ship or you have to move someplace else, that takes a factor. Time is a big factor.
Dr. Hostetter, now, you know, when it comes to college kids, you always got to somehow entice them to come do these things. I know y'all gave out T-shirts.
We did.
Did that get them coming in?
You know, it did. We've given out T-shirts. We parked University of Georgia parked a coffee truck out in front of the testing area so that on their way out, the participants could get a hot cup of coffee. And that has been, you know, we've seen an uptick in our folks that are volunteering for the test. And so that's been useful.
And this test, either one of you all can answer this. This test was obviously adapted in-house and being conducted only on the campus. Is any plans to expand this maybe outside of UGA or to another, you know, University of System Georgia institution?
At this point, we don't have plans to move outside of UGA. We're trying to make sure that we can meet our need here with testing as many students, faculty, and staff as we can. We don't know down the road if that will change, but that's where we are right now.
As we wrap up, and Dr. Hostetter, I'll start with you in answering this question. Where do you hope we'll be maybe by the end of the summer or as we get toward the end of the year? Where do you hope we'll be as a nation in terms of having COVID-19, obviously from mitigating the spread to having more folks vaccinated? Just through your lens, where do you hope this nation will be by then?
Well, I truly hope that, you know, with vaccination that we can, and all of our mitigation efforts, social distancing, mask, that we can bring the incidence down and that we can start to achieve that level of immunity that we hope to with vaccination. We can start taking steps back to normal again. It would sure be nice to do some of the things that we all love to do and we have avoided because of the pandemic. It would be nice here at UGA to have that specter of fear and concern mm-hmm. begin to dissipate so that we can return safely and without worry back to our normal routine.
And whatever normal will be, right? Dr. Sanchez, I'll give you the last word. What do you think?
Thank you. I totally agree with Dr. Hostetter. I just hope that we have a better uptake on the vaccine and that we really reach out to all the communities that need it and that we make a great effort to increase the number of people that do get it. And then we'll be really where we need to be in sense of less hospitalizations, less deaths, and hopefully less incidence of disease. Mm-hmm. And so we can resume life, but I don't see us stopping wearing masks for a little while longer, I'm afraid.
All right, Dr. Susan Sanchez, professor of infectious diseases at UGA and the head of the microbiology and molecular biology in UGA's College of Veterinary Medicine Diagnostic Laboratory, and Dr. Jesse Hostetter, the Barry G. Harmon Professor of Pathology in the College of Veterinary Medicine, and also Executive Director of the Tifton and Athens Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratories. Thank you both for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Thank you for what you all are doing. I have a suggestion now. You've got coffee and T-shirts. You throw some donuts in there, you might get the whole campus.
Excellent idea.
Thank
We're
you.
Going to take that under consideration.
Thank you both so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Back in 2018, she was just a second grader attending Anzia Elementary School in El Cajon out in San Diego. But little Samantha said this during her TEDx Kids. Take a listen.
I'm passionate about engineering. Why? Well, I just have a feeling it's a great job for me. But did you know only 14% of engineering jobs are held by women? It's hard to do something without a role model. Can you imagine not having anybody in your life that you could look up to, ask questions, or inspire you to be? Women have a hard time finding the inspiration they need to accomplish their dreams of becoming an engineer. Women need more role models to help us achieve our goals. Engineering is really, and I mean absolutely, interesting. It's full of problem solving, hands-on fun, and teamwork.
There you go. Well, let's talk about what Samantha had to say. Also, this is Engineers Week. So joining me now, first up from Spelman College, Dr. Raquel Hill. She's the chair and professor in the Department of Computer and Information Sciences and the faculty advisor for Spelman's championship-winning robotics team. Also, Dr. Krista Walton, the associate dean of research for the College of Engineering at Georgia Tech. And Christina Caldwell, professional engineer, educator, engineering consultant, and author. Thank you all for taking the time and happy Engineers Week.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Dr. Hill, let's start with you. Can you recall at what age when engineering, you thought, you know what, this is going to be it for me? You heard what little Samantha had to say when she was just in second grade. What about you? When did it hit you?
I think that I didn't think about it from the perspective of being an engineer. Mm-hmm. I thought about it from the perspective of being a mathematician. Because I didn't know about engineering when I was in the second grade, I knew that I loved math. And so becoming a computer scientist became clear to me when I was a senior in high school and I took my first computer science programming course at my high school, which they currently don't have anymore, which is very disappointing. So I saw computer programming as an extension of mathematics and the problem solving that I love to do with mathematics. And I decided at that point that I would be a computer scientist because I saw the application of the math that I was using and that I was so excited and passionate about, and math had been my favorite subject. And so at that point, I decided I would be a computer scientist, never having met a computer scientist.
Wow.
Other than taking the computer programming course that was taught by my math professor.
Dr. Walton, what about you? When did it hit you?
Yeah, similar to Dr. Hill, I actually never knew any engineers. I was a first-generation college student. And I went to space camp when I was young, and that was sort of my first thing that, well, actually I wanted to be an astronaut, but I was like, if I'm an engineer, maybe I can be an astronaut. Mm-hmm. And so then high school chemistry later is what really gave me the bug. And I just knew I wanted to pursue something related to chemistry that turned into chemical engineering by the time I was a senior. I really have my high school chemistry teacher to thank. Her husband was a chemical engineer.
Wow.
And that was sort of my one connection to that. Yeah.
Christina Caldwell, what about you? When did it hit you?
So it was probably, I did a little bit of a switch. When I was young, I really liked to build things. I liked to see how things worked. And it was everything from electronics. I successfully and unsuccessfully took things apart in my house. And then I decided I liked to draw as well. So probably around 7 or 8, I wanted to be an architect. So on the road of being an architect, I learned about different people like Paul Williams, mm-hmm. and very innovative designers that way. As I got into high school, though, I figured out architects are way more creative than I happened to be. I was very logical, very good at math. I wanted A plus B to equal C and no deviation. So since I figured out there was no, not a lot of creativity, I actually started asking around, and actually in the Paul Williams story, he had gotten an architectural engineering degree. So mm-hmm. that's the first time I had heard of that. And then someone else mentioned, a counselor mentioned it. Like these ladies, I didn't know any architects. There weren't any in my family. No one to kind of bounce ideas off of. But mm-hmm. once a counselor mentioned architectural engineer, I did a switch from wanting to be an architect to studying architectural engineering.
You know, all it takes is a simple Google of diversity in engineering. And of course, a lot comes up. You get, why is diversity in engineering a major opportunity? We must increase diversity in the field of engineering. The importance of diversity in engineering. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had about this on our program. And Dr. Walton, I want to start with you. We're still having these conversations. We're still asking these same questions. People talk about, well, you need to start in as early as elementary school. Access, role models, increasing the pipeline. Is it still all these same issues that need to be tackled?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, you know, it is getting better. And I mean, research does show that if you don't have girls interested in science, math, and STEM fields by the time they're, say, in middle school, then you've often lost them and you don't get it back. So it's really important in those early years to get that. But I think that, you know, as comparing now to when I was in college in the 90s, I do think that certain fields within engineering are making better inroads than others. So the chemical engineering, biomedical, a lot of the environmental, they have made better inroads to increasing, especially on the women, the side of getting more women in. But we still have a lot of work to do on that.
Dr. Hill, Dr. Rawlins said there's still a lot of work to do. It's 2021. Can you assess the progress and then just add, okay, where is the issue then? Where do we begin to address this?
Yes, there is still a lot of work to do. I think about, you know, when I started, and one of the things I was blessed, and I say blessed because things happened by chance. I was blessed to go to Georgia Tech and have Dr. Andrea Lawrence as a graduate, a PhD student at the time while I was an undergrad. And she was pursuing her PhD in computer science. And she was the first African-American to receive a PhD in computer science at Georgia, from Georgia Tech. And so I saw that happening and I saw the struggles. And because it was a tight-knit group of African-American and Black PhD students and with the undergrads. And so just seeing that at the time I was an undergrad, I didn't realize that I would later go on and pursue a PhD. But, you know, just to have that role model, and she was the first African-American with a PhD in computer science that I knew, and I saw her do it. And so when there is that role model is not there, it's hard to try to envision yourself in that role. And then I think one of the major challenges is not necessarily dealing with the academics and what is required, mm-hmm. but all the social nuances and problems that you encounter that can set up roadblocks for a student. And so not only do we have to deal with the academics when you're a woman and when you are a woman of color, but you also have to deal with societal issues, you know, systemic biases that are just ingrained in the culture and things of that nature. And so you have extra work to do, you know, that others may not have to do. And that creates, you know, a major stumbling block and roadblock for many.
Let me ask Christina Caldwell this then. Based on what you just heard Dr. Hill talk about, I'm sure that's not lost on you.
Not at all. Dr. Hill hit the nail on the head. That has been my experience as I've navigated the path of professional engineering licensure. So after I got my master's, I went into electrical, was what my chosen choice of field. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, there really are not a lot of people of color, and especially women in electrical specifically. Mm-hmm. So I did early in my career meet one, but since her, in over 13 years, I've not met another person that looks like me in the field. And especially not many as I started to get into management and upper levels of supervising other people. So it's definitely a lot of isms, is what I like to call it, that I've had to face and overcome and figure out the best way to be an advocate for myself and not stand up for it while maintaining employment and not kind of ostracizing myself during those times.
Dr. Walton, have you had students who were feeling, feeling a certain kind of way about being in the program? Maybe you heard what Dr. Hill, you heard what Christina just had to say. Have you had students come to you and feel like they're alone? There's been some isolation throughout your career at all. And could you understand what they were going through? And how did you help them?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been a faculty member for almost 15 years. And I think, you know, so much comes to me, especially these days, with students that are having both interpersonal issues and experiencing racism or sexism from their peers. But occasionally, you know, they're experiencing it in the classroom. And these are I always tell them, you know, they think they're overreacting, but, you know, these things are nuanced now. Nobody's mm-hmm. going to come out, usually, or not going to come right out and say, you don't belong here. Mm-hmm. It's subtle. And, you know, they feel crazy. And it's all these microaggressions that add up. And so I think the best thing I can do is just, you know, give them an example of someone who is in it and provide that support for them and connect them with others if it needs to go beyond me. But I think just providing that example and the support for people that are going through any kind of hard time, that's how you retain them and keep them in the field and encourage them to keep going.
In doing the research for this segment, and I came across a statistic that cited that, you know, there was a 30%, I believe it said 30% of women who had majored in some engineering field, 20 years later, they were not even working in the field. Dr. Hill, what do you make of that? Is that surprising at all?
I'm not surprised. I think that probably all of us on this call right now would possibly say there's been some time in our career that we considered leaving it. And so because of those challenges that we've discussed, I think it's our passion for, you know, the area that keeps us going. And then there's also, you know, when you're going through a challenge, somebody else is going to experience that same challenge. Mm-hmm. And so they're looking for us to persist. And so that when we're on the other side, we can reach back and we can actually be a guide for them. And so I think, you know, those two things, you know, keep me problem solving. I still like to solve problems. I'm still, you know, very interested and excited about problem solving. And also I know that I'm not just a computer scientist for mm-hmm. me and because I like to solve problems, but I am a computer scientist for those who want to be computer scientists but they don't know what it is and they don't see anyone else that looks like them. And so when they encounter, you know, me, I become for them what they know that they can be.
Christina Caldwell, well, for little Samantha that we heard coming into this segment, let's say in 20 years, where do you hope this industry will be? And I know when we talk about diversity and inclusion and equity, depending on who you ask, everybody's got their own definition. I think I'm going to stop asking people to define diversity because you get all kind of different answers. But for someone like little Samantha in 20 years, what is your hope where this industry will be in terms of women in engineering? And not just women in engineering, because that's such a blanket statement, you know?
Yes, ma'am. I agree. I hope that it's not something that she'll have to look for. Samantha seems excited about the industry because she likes it, but also Dr. Hill made a good point. It's difficult when you don't see someone that looks like you while you're trying to do something. So my hope is that she won't have to go searching for someone that she can relate to mm-hmm. for mentorship. It can be a little bit overwhelming, or you'll have a little bit of fear if you don't feel like you can connect on some level with someone you see as a mentor. So I hope in 20 years that is a non-factor for her, that she will see someone that she can relate to and get the type of guidance and mentorship that will make her the best scientist, technologist, engineer, mathematician that she wants to be.
Yeah, I think Samantha's going to be running something. Trust me on that. Dr. Walden, what role, responsibility does institutions like Georgia Tech play in all of this through your lens?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think so much of these issues we're discussing about representation, it's the pipeline. So, you know, at Georgia Tech, we have about a third of our undergraduate engineering population, about a third of them are women, but the national average is more like 17%. So mm-hmm. we have to partner with the K-12 groups and, you know, how do we promote this to the younger ages? And we can't wait till they're seniors. It has to happen in middle school. Mm-hmm. And you've got to increase that pipeline, because once we have closer to, you know, reflecting our population in our programs, then that pipeline keeps feeding up to all the various levels. And then it does hopefully become something that you, as a woman or a person of color, you don't feel so othered when you enter these fields.
Dr. Hill, I want you to let our listeners know, as we begin to wrap up, who may not be familiar with that incredible Spellbot team. I covered something from you all years ago, but the robotics teams is just, it's amazing over there. So I'm going to allow you to brag on them a little bit.
Well, I think it is an amazing group of young women, and, you know, they're resilient and versatile. COVID took us online, but we found ways to engage and interact, you know, even in a virtual setting. And so they're continuing what they've done in the past and improving their skill set virtually by using, you know, online platforms that allow them to use virtual robotic agents and hone their skills on sensing and having the robots do predictive movements and things of that nature. We're looking forward to the opportunity where we can be back in person so we can continue our engagement with K through 12, as Dr. Walton has mentioned, because it is so very important. Mm-hmm. And so the Spellbots team, I am the faculty advisor, but it is a student-led program. And so they're actually doing a lot to keep the engagement going. And I also want to say, regarding like having a presence in students actually seeing someone that they can connect to. Mm-hmm. It is even when they don't see someone that looks like them. If those who are in the field will not just will have high expectations for those students actually performing, mm-hmm. that is very key. And not only provide mentorship, but advocacy, go before them and create a path of success for them and advocate for them to have opportunities that others are offered, but women and women of color are often not given. I think that is just as important as having someone that looks like them, you know, in those roles.
You just had some head shakes and agreement from Christina and Dr. Walton. Thank you both so much. Thank all three of you for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Dr. Raquel Hill, the chair and professor in the Department of Computer and Information Sciences and a faculty advisor for Spellman's robotics team. Dr. Crystal Walton, the associate dean of research for the College of Engineering at Georgia Tech. And Christina Caldwell, professional engineer, educator, engineering consultant, and author. Thank you all for taking the time. Thank you all for what you've been doing for so many young women and girls. Keep doing it. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Grace Walker and LaShawn Hudson. Our engineer is Kevin Rinker. If you missed any of today's program, it's always online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, Closer Look weeknights at 8 p.m. as well in our podcasts. Subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like, because it will be there. So stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.